Hey,
welcome to the Meat House. This is Jeff.
Hey, this is Chris. Today we're talking about storing meat. Bottle storing, in this case.
Bottle storing, but we'll talk a little bit about bulk aging, too, I think. You know,
we got that last time, yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, before we get rolling, though, I wanted to say thank you to our audience, because over the past few weeks, I've had so many of you guys, former listeners, even co-hosts or two, reach out and say, hey, glad to see that you're back and doing your thing, and really excited to see what you come up with it. The support, love is really appreciated, guys.
Really appreciate. I mean, I am grateful. I really am.
You know, you guys are the ones we're making this for, so that's. I'm glad you're appreciating it. I hope you like the direction we're going with this, and you have some fun with us, because this has been a lot of fun so far, and I only see it getting better.
Yeah, and actually, I'm really enjoying it, because I'm just having more and more fun. I love the fact what I'm learning now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could have pieced this out of everything I've been reading, but it's more fun to talk.
Yes, yeah. The dialogue between, and you and I have been friends for a good long time. We have a good, back and forth kind of chemistry together that I think lends itself well to this kind of thing.
I think we do well. All right. The meat today is from Fitzgibbon Meadery. It's their Ember Tangerine Mead.
Nice. Tangerine sounds.
And that sound is delightful. Now, this is about the same color as the last one, so I think it's between a straw and a gold.
Yeah, this is a straw color. It's maybe a dark straw, but it's a nice light one. Very clear.
Oh my goodness, you can smell that though. That's got some fragrance in there.
Mm-hmm. No, this is one of those where the fruit definitely does take center stage, at least in the bouquet category.
Oh my God, that's
I'm getting hardly any honey compared to the fruit.
And it's also not as, it doesn't have, it has a lighter, a lower viscosity. It's not as thick as the famous one.
Yeah, no, this is pretty light. This is, this tastes like a white wine to me. It's a little thin. Do we know what ABV this guy is at all? 14%.
14? Oh, that's pretty
respectable, actually. For as light as this is, I would not expect it to be that alcoholic.
No, I would have thought it'd been around closer to 10.
Yeah, I was thinking 10 to 12 myself. So, yeah, nice. And the flavor, though, is, yeah, there's a little tangerine tartness. It's light. It's, I don't want to say playful, but it's.
And the ember in the name, there's got a little bit of a zip in there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not so much even I can handle it. It's not bad.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you remember our last show, that I was shocked to find out that there was capsaicin in the meat I had that day. And,
My
wife, your wife, and even you a little bit were just, oh my God, this is funny. And it was. And, yeah. And I can take it.
And I can tell you from the editorial standpoint, it didn't get any less funny the second time around.
Great. Well, I'm glad I'm good for humor. But no, this one's a very mild heat to it.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. I mean, it works well with the tangerine.
No, I'm not getting any kind of like real appreciable heat level on it.
It's really light. I mean, even for me. Maybe it's just called Ember, but you know.
I think it is just called Ember. It's got an acidity to it that is.
Maybe that's what I'm tasting.
Yeah. Because it has a tingle on the tongue from the acidity for sure.
That's what I was thinking was the Ember part.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't think this has any kind of necessarily spicy components, but it's nice.
It is a good meat. So, you know, shout out to Fitzgibbon Meadery. That's admirable.
Yeah, that's a nice little drink.
All right. Yeah, and take care of our other thing there. Box and Barleycorn is our sponsor. We're very grateful to them for sponsoring us and helping us bring this information out to you. Box and Barleycorn has all your mead and fermenting needs.
Fermenting, cheese making, vinegar. They've got a little bit of distilling stuff too. Yeah.
And they even have like for kombucha, you know,
all kinds of good stuff. So, give them a shout. You can follow our link in the doobly doo, your show notes, and use our promo code MHP10 to get 10% off of your purchases. Please go ahead.
And tell Jake in the end where you heard it. Where you heard it from us.
Absolutely.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, we appreciate you guys listening. They'll appreciate knowing that their sponsorship here is going to a good end. So,
now, on with the today is about aging and storing meat.
Right.
Now, the standard is glass bottles, corked. But there are other options.
There are a lot of other options.
Now, the first one we're looking at, a standard bottle, 750 milliliters, is around 12 and a half ounces American fluid. No?
It's higher.
Really? 25.
25 ounces.
25. I'm sorry. For some reason, I've been working with half-size bottles recently, so that was stuck in my brain. I apologize for that.
375s are nice too. I like those as a bottling metric, especially if it's something I'm giving away. That then you get twice as many bottles to give away.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Just what I don't need right now. I mean, I was talking to Jeff today, and I counted the number of cases of 750 milliliter bottles I have in my stored right now, and I have like 14 cases of,
14 cases, 12 bottles each.
yeah, of like six, seven, eight, nine, 10, about 12 types of mead I've made recently. And mind you, I'm not mad about that, but there's going to come a point really, really soon. My wife's in here, dear.
Space is at a premium.
Space is at a premium.
Oh, yeah. So.
But anyway, so let's start with, okay, glass bottles are the preferred. Because you need something that's not permeable, easy to clean. And as a amateur bead maker, I have a great benefit of I can reuse bottles.
Bottles are nice for that regard because as long as they have a kind of closure that is coordinatable, or as long as they have a kind of closure you can reclose, instead of like a screw top cap off
Yeah.
of some of the cheaper glass beer bottles, you can reuse those ad nauseum. I have cases and cases of glass that have been hanging around for an age and a day. For example, I think I still have almost a whole case of some of the like clear glass bottles that we had one of the beers that at my wedding
Wow. Okay.
almost
Yeah.
10 years ago now.
That's a moment ago.
Yeah.
And here's a quick tip for you. If you want to get bottles for yourself fairly cheaply, you don't have to buy new. Go to a meadery that offers samples
Or winery
or
or
winery or and ask to buy their used bottles. As a professional meadery, as a commercial meadery or winery, they can't reuse them. They'll generally give you away at a very decent price, and they've got so many they'd love to not throw away.
You can also do the same at higher ed restaurants, although you're not going to get like matched cases that way, because they're getting, a dozen different types of wine to put on their wine list, and you're getting whatever they have empty. But they have the same problem of they have all these glass bottles that need to be recycled. So, I know a couple of people that used to go to like Olive Garden or wherever, before they started doing different packaging for some of their house wines.
Yeah.
And dude, it works.
And they are more and best, they're more than glad to get them to you. I mean, some people will give them away, some people are just really cheap. Either way, you're getting good bottles, reusable bottles, just takes a little bit of cleaning, not a problem.
For a lot of businesses, glass bottles are kind of like pallets. There are people that want them. There are businesses that have them, and more often than not, have them in such a quantity that they have to pay somebody else to get rid of them.
Yeah.
So,
Help them out.
yeah. Take advantage. Another great thing, if you have a bunch of bottles and you need cases, go to your local liquor store. Because if you think about it, their wine selection, usually they have like the open racks where they stack wine 12 deep. What do you think they do with those boxes? If you need a box, just ask.
Just ask. They'll throw them in your direction almost.
Like the Total Wine by Us that I've talked about a few weeks back, like they have an entire wall of boxes, just like if somebody is buying a bunch and they want to just throw stuff in a box, take it. And so I was cleaning bottles, I think last summer, and they, I had more bottles than I had boxes to put them in at the moment. So I went in there and was like, "Hey, see how you got all? I see you guys have got all these boxes. Do you mind if I take a couple?" They're like, "Sure. Don't grab the ones at the top. We're holding those for special purposes. But anything at the bottom, just to help yourself, as
Yeah.
many as you want."
And there you go. I mean, network out, guys. I mean, you can do this. Okay, let's talk about capping. The standard is corks. So there are two types of corks I'm aware of. One's a natural cork, one's a nylon cork.
Nylon is not necessarily the best term for that. I would use the term synthetic.
So, okay, synthetic.
And then bear in mind, there are a number of different types of cork, natural cork. There are a number of different types of synthetic corks as well. So bear in mind that, like, for better or for worse, if you get a bottle of wine and it has a screw cap, or the, like a plasticky looking closure to it. What is the first thing you think, generally speaking?
Cheap.
Yeah, it's cheap. It's not fancy.
Cheap. Yeah.
And
And that's not necessarily true. I've had some perfectly palatable lines out of those, but it's not what you think.
right. This is about a perception thing. Now, the unfortunate part as homebrewers, though, is that the kind of corks that you can generally find, the natural cork at a homebrew store, you're not getting winery grade cork. That's going to the big businesses. They get first dibs on all that. Generally, the kind of whole natural cork you're getting, second, third class at best. It's not something I would use for long-term storage. As far as just closing a bottle, keeping it safe for a year or two, yeah, you're probably good there.
So how long would you give a natural cork as a lifespan for the wine in the bottle?
It depends on the quality of the cork.
Let's say you're lucky and you get grade C cork.
All things being equal, and we will talk about how to store these after they've been corked a little later in the episode, but as long as the storage is nice, I would say like a grade C cork, I would guess 2, 3 years tops.
Okay. So and a little more time with the B.
A little more time with it, you would risk things like oxidization, cork taint, maybe even vinegar and nasty stuff like that.
Right. All right. Oh, great. That seemed like a legitimate question right there. Now, the synthetic corks.
Synthetic corks, there's a range of those as well. Some of them are unfortunately like, I don't want to say cheaper, but they're not made as well. There's also in this range things like the little T corks. I'm sure you've seen like the top of it is the full width of the bottle, but there's an insert part with little like flare
Like
edges.
what you kind of usually see with like champagne bottles that have the big cork piece on top and the thinner piece below it.
Kind of, sort of, except this one has little like tapered edges that will like fill to the edge of the bottle.
Okay.
Now, these are also sometimes referred to as tasting corks because they can be put back in and out. Like if you're at a wine tasting event, or if you're working at a bar and you sell wine by the glass, these are used in that case because it's easy to get the cork in and out. You can fill a glass; you don't have it exposed to outside air. Unfortunately, these are not great. These are not a permanent, like long-term closure kind of situation. I wouldn't rate them for more than a few months
Okay,
storage.
so what would be a your opinion of a quality synthetic cork?
Quality synthetic corks. There's a brand called Nomacork. They are a synthetic cork. They have been in the industry for a very long time, and they have a number of different solutions available for, I've seen for the big winemaking customers. They have things like recycled materials or ecologically sustainable materials, a lot of really cool initiatives. Those don't get filtered down to the homebrew market though, but they have their standard variety of Noma cork that is actually getting fairly reasonable price these days. And I would rate the Noma cork, like standard cork, 10 years easily.
10 years. Okay,
Yeah.
nice. Ten
No,
years. Cool.
they are made to avoid cork taint, which is something that natural cork can happen with. And they're actually a fairly strong, like oxygen seal as well. So
Nice.
it's definitely something to look at. And another type of cork that we could talk about here is agglomerated cork. I don't know if you've seen these. These are the kind that I used for a very long time. But basically, when they're making corks for wineries and things like that, they end up with something that looks like Swiss cheese. The
Okay.
big thing of cork is has all these holes punched out of it, and they've got all these little bits and bobs from between the circles. They will grind those up and then use pressure and some like adhesives and things like that to make an agglomerated cork.
Okay.
Basically, it looks like it's the particle board of cork.
Okay, yeah, I was about to say particle board. That
Right.
sounds exactly like what it was.
But that I would rate as higher than a grade C, like little cork piece from that we could get cheap at the homebrew store.
Okay.
Those I would say 2 to 5 years solid.
Okay. Not bad. Not bad. All right. Now, before we go into my third option I have listed here, I want to talk to you, what about waxing or sealing the top of the bottle after corking?
So, I'm not sure about waxing. Wax is a natural material. I know a lot of people will use paraffin wax, which is not necessarily natural. I think that is a petroleum byproduct or a petroleum product. from what I've been told, the easy way to do that, if you're looking for wax seals, is to mix equal parts of an amount of paraffin wax with crayons.
Like Crayola?
Yeah.
Really?
For the color. Yeah.
Okay.
You choose the color you want, mix equal parts, and you get a very colorful, even seal that's relatively easy to get through and clean up. I'm not sure what that does for you as far as oxygen permeability.
Okay, fair. And how about these heat, you put a seal over it and you hit it with a heat gun and shrinks on the bottle. How about those?
You know what I use those for? To tell which batch is which before I go make labels.
Just labeling.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
If I have a red seal on this one, that's my hibiscus, and the yellow seal, that's my semi-sweet traditional or whatever,
Okay.
just so that I can tell them apart. I don't expect any kind of additional sealing power or durability from those. Those are a marking and like an aesthetic tool only, in
Okay.
my way of thinking.
Now,
I could be wrong.
okay, fair. But as you were talking, I'd actually looked up paraffin wax. It is a petroleum-based wax.
Yeah. So.
So, quick little research there. And so you would not recommend a petroleum-based wax, though,
I don't know if
per
it's going to
se.
do anything for you.
Okay.
I don't know if it's going to be a problem. Like I said, from what I've heard, people will go to the candle supply store and buy, let's say, a 3 ounce thing of paraffin wax somebody uses to make a candle, and add 3 ounces worth of orange Crayola crayons to make an orange thing that they can dip their bottle tops in, and it makes a good
So
seal.
would you say mostly these seals are just for aesthetic purposes more than anything else?
I think so. I wouldn't count on them to be anything for long-term durability. I think they are just to make it look nice, in the same way that, unfortunately, corks are to make your bottle look nice. The wax seal is going to be in that same ballpark.
Okay, fair enough. All right, now the golden shoe I know is actually kind of cool. Some places have actually started bottle capping wines. And the advantage is actually kind of impressive.
Right.
For example, I think you told me once upon a time that they've had some that have been 25 years and still has good seal.
Yes. The thing about bottle caps, as much as we have a number of advances in the wine industry in this country, we have so many more advances in the beer industry because the macro breweries are effing huge. They're putting out volume-wise so much more. And there are as many people that are in my boat where if I go to the store and I buy a six pack of beer, that six pack is gone in a week or two.
Yeah.
As there are, people like my mom who will go to the store and buy a six pack of, the Boulevard Pale Ale for me and my brother-in-law to have at Thanksgiving dinner, and it's still there by Easter because we had one or two each.
Okay.
And
It just sits there.
there is durability to consider here. And like we talked about before, they say, hey, if you buy a Budweiser in Kansas City or Denver or New York City or San Francisco or hell in Paris, it needs to taste like a Budweiser.
Yeah, it always will.
Right. And so there are the closure is another factor where things can get in there. They have put so much effort into like the oxidative, like preventive coating inside that bottle cap that, yeah, bottle caps will last for ages untouched. It's
Wow.
wild. And it's a bottle cap. It's like that's a silicone seal with a little tin piece of metal. There's no cork, there's no cork taint. The oxygen permeability is virtually none. So it's a great long-term storage solution, but unfortunately, like a screw top, it looks cheap.
Yeah, and I'm now thinking of, just to give you an idea of my age, I remember the Muppet movie when Steve Martin comes up to Miss Piggy and Kermit and say, pops the bottle cap off the brain. Would you like to smell the bottle cap? This may be a thing now. You could actually have bottle cap and have it, and in this case, have a good wine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, okay, let's talk about, now corking a bottle is a procedure. I have a nice lever action ground stand corker,
Floor
a
based.
floor base.
Yeah.
I had one that wasn't, and I would like to say I liked it, but I didn't.
Yeah, no, the I worked at Boxes of Barleycorn for something like a year and a half, and whenever I got to, people that were just new at this and were getting into corking their first batch, I talked them through this and was like, "Hey, look, here's the deal. There are hand corkers, there are floor corkers. The hand corkers are great if you want a shoulder workout. They're not
It
necessarily
is.
great at corking a wine bottle. You can do it, sure."
But you're pushing.
Oh, God, those floor. Once I got a floor corker, oh my God.
I once I got mine, I never went back.
Right.
My hand corker is still in the closet. I don't know what I'm gonna do with
Yeah,
it.
no, you're engaging like the entire waist up torso, getting that, like leaning over the bottle, pushing down on the lever action arms.
It happens when I hold that bottle so tight
Right.
so you can get that cork in there.
Yeah, no, it's if it's not a two-person job, it's a little bit dangerous, and more often than not, I was sticking it into like the arch of my feet and holding it that way. Like,
Oh
this is just not a great thing. I don't recommend it, but a floor, I'm sorry, a hand corker, it's like what, 20, 30 bucks
Yeah, I mean,
for the
it's pretty,
floor
and a
corker.
floor corker is what? How much do you remember it being?
I think they go from anywhere from 75 to maybe 150, depending on the model and the features and things like that. But,
Even the basic 75 one is so much better. That's what I use, and obviously, since like I mentioned earlier, I've got 14 cases now. I corked all of those things, and I can do it by myself.
Well, and the amount of effort to move that arm down, it's barely any difference if there's a bottle and a cork that you're trying to fit into it, or if it's just empty,
Yeah, it's
it's.
negligible.
It does so much of the work for you that, like, night and day, night and
But
day.
on the same token, now here's where I was going with this, a bottle capper.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. There is a hand capper. They don't have a floor capper. They have a benchtop capper. Both of them are cheaper than
And
the
they are
corkers.
both easier than a hand corker for corks.
Yes. If you're going to get into bottle capping, though, skip the hand capper. It is the for a price difference, we're talking like $10 or $15 versus $30 or $40 for a bench top. And the hand capper is unfortunately designed such that, think about it, when you're putting a cap on something, the crinkly ends, you have to crimp those in around the rim of the bottle. The hand capper is designed such that you kind of have to hit a sweet spot with pressure, otherwise you can crack your bottles. And unfortunately, if you have a full bottle of mead and you crack the top of it,
You're
there's
throwing out the
glass.
whole thing.
Yeah, you've lost that bottle. You've probably got little bits of glass into the mead. You can't just decant it into a different bottle. This is just a loss. A benchtop capper is very much in the same regard as a floor corker. It's cheaper. You stick the cap on the bottle, you stick the bottle under the little crimper, and it's got like a little bowl-shaped piece of metal that you just press over it. It's even pressure all the way around. I have never broken a bottle that way,
And so it depends, and honestly, caps are cheaper than corks,
ever.
markedly.
Yes.
I mean, if you want to do this and save yourself a little money here and there with a perfectly legitimate way of capping your bottles or corking your bottles, closing your bottles, a capper is not a bad choice.
And realistically, like a 750 mil bottle of mead, if we're talking like a 14 to 18% ABV, if I have someone to share it with, 750 is not that bad of a deal.
No.
You're going to get silly drinking 750 alone.
Quick, especially on the 14, 18% range.
Right. A little 12-ounce bottle of a 14 to 18% mead, that's still quite a bit, but I mean, that's.
Much more manageable.
Right. That's I had enough to make me happy, good buzz. Now I'm sleepy. Now I'm going to go to bed. So
And I've had the same thing. So, yeah.
if you're making it mainly for yourself or for friends and aesthetics are not as big of a deal, God, beer bottles are kind of the way to go, to my way of thinking.
And again, go to your local bars. Beer bottles are, they're everywhere.
Here's the problem with beer bottles, though. If you're going to cap beer bottles, you can't use the screw top type. Those are actually much thinner than the rounded ones. So you if you try to recap those,
You have to get the better beer bottles.
not only will those not seal, you're more likely to break them even with a benchtop capper.
Okay, I didn't know that.
So yeah, to my consternation, a lot of beer companies in that they're not quite macro breweries, but they're still bigger micro breweries, will also do fancy bottles. So they have like Sam Adams or their little logo embossed in the glass. And I don't like that because it makes it look like I just scrounged empty bottles and refilled them. And I don't care that I did that. I just don't want it to look like I did that.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I didn't realize that the screw tops were that big of a difference in the capping process. So
Absolutely.
that's
I
good information.
do not use those at all.
Okay. Now, there's another thing. I like using clear bottles because I like displaying the color of my mead. It's purely aesthetic. It has nothing to do with anything. I do know that colored bottles offer a level of protection against sun and such like that. It kind of depends, in my opinion, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to display what you're making, like I do, clear is the way to go. I highly recommend the flat bottom bottles. They have the some bottles have an arch in the middle of them on the bottom.
Yeah, that dimple on the bottom is a pain in the butt, especially if you're using a bottling wand to fill it, because that bottling wand little bit nibbly bob will slip.
And so I get the flat bottom, and that it works great every time. Color, okay, there's brown. I've seen blue. I don't know if there's any other. There's probably green out there.
Green is very popular in the Bordeaux wine bottle style for red wines.
Okay, fair.
There are a couple different reasons you would want to use a colored bottle. Aesthetics are one of them. The blue bottle especially, I think, is an aesthetic choice more than anything else, because I'm not sure that blue conveys all that much protection. Green and brown are popular both in winemaking and to a lesser extent in beer making too, because they protect against a level of UV intrusion in wine and beer.
And even I know this, UV intrusion is where the UV light gets into the body and it taints, as it were. It alters the
There are
liquid.
a couple different ways this can work. The main one is, and this is, as I understand it, can be a factor for a mead, a wine, a beer, anything of the sort. It's called light strike, and the UV light kind of throws odd, weird flavors and things like that. It's unfortunate. It happens. When we talk about, other factors related to proper storage, we'll be in a better place to make that work. The other thing we need to think about in terms of storage color is the effect on the adjuncts you're putting into your mead or your wine or your beer or whatever. One of the reasons that you only see beer generally sold in brown or green bottles is because the UV intrusion can affect the hops that are in beer. And that makes them skunky. Literally, it smells like skunk.
Musk.
It's not good.
Skunk musk.
And unfortunately, for the longest time, even the green bottles, they only do so much. I used to, as I've talked about a time or two before, I lived in the Czech Republic for about 3 years, and I do love me some Czech beer. But unfortunately, by the time you get Czech beer to the middle of this country, it's kind of skunky. Unless it's been, you can't just get six packs because that green doesn't stop it all the time.
Okay.
And then I've had much better luck with companies that bottle in brown, and I've had much better luck with companies that have like full enclosed 12 packs that are covered in cardboard than I do with just green bottles for whatever reason. I'm sure they're in shipping containers the entire time. I don't know why there's a difference, but there
There
seems to
is.
be. Yeah.
Okay.
By the same token, though, for us as mead makers, especially us as mead makers, you doing like fruit meads and fun colors and things like that, the UV light can also have an effect on especially the anthocyanins that make so much of the red color in a lot of the fruits that we're harvesting and playing with. That can also degrade those to the point where those will almost like oxidization, they will start to turn brown. You'll get some of those particles
Does that
coming
affect
out.
flavor? I mean, the color, affecting the color, does that affect the flavor?
It can,
Okay.
yes. Those are also part of what make it taste the way it does in some respects. That degrading those also degrades the quality of the meat.
Okay. Now, I will say the first batch of blackberry vanilla I ever made, a lot of it, it was a 7 gallon batch. I was very ambitious, and it worked out well. Thankfully, because I probably would have cried myself into never doing it again. But It worked out well, but by the same token, that is a lot of bottles. Yeah,
For
talk,
sure. 7 gallons,
like 30 bottles.
right? 35,
30 or 35
roughly.
bottles.
My rule of thumb generally is, 5 750s for every gallon.
Yeah.
It's going to be a little less than that, but
I generally gauge around 4.5 per gallon, but that's just me. I didn't, I did not get, they were not all drunk quickly because it was me, my wife, and occasionally my adult children, very occasionally. And about a year later, you mentioned that it's the color has gone down. And I wasn't good enough at the tasting process to know a huge difference at that point. So I don't know if it affected the flavor a whole lot, but I did notice the color was not as nearly as attractive. It lost a lot of that rich purple color.
That
And
is, unfortunately, the reds and the purples are those anthocyanins that are part of the natural fruit we're harvesting and using. Now, here's the question. Aside from the bottle, how did you store the bottles?
okay, I had them in a cardboard box
Good.
in my basement in the closet.
Okay.
It was cool. And that was my next section, actually. How does temperature affect storage?
So, from what I've seen, obviously, you wouldn't want to keep it in, like, the boiler room
No.
of your house. You want to keep it relatively cool. The important thing, from what I understand it, is less an absolute temperature. Like, we're not going to say, hey, keep it at, 54 degrees. We're going to say, keep it steady.
So you're looking
Because,
for a consistency rather than a level.
right, swings in temperature can affect it more, as I am given to understand it. I could be wrong. I am not a food scientist here by any stretch of the imagination, but as I am given to understand it, swings in temperature are worse for long-term storage than an abject temperature gradient is.
Okay, so I was under the impression that cool temperatures are better. I mean, I know, we already said you don't want it hot because
And
that will literally cook your.
I think as a general rule, yes, that is correct. What we would classify as room temperature to cellar temperature. So let's say objectively, like low to mid 70s at the highest to like 50s at the lowest.
Okay.
Those are all probably good temperatures to keep it at.
But most importantly is consistent temperature.
Yeah, keep it stable.
Don't move it around in new areas that are different temperatures.
Right. Another thing that is important is light intrusion. Whether you're going to keep it in a closet or in a cardboard box, you want to keep it away from direct sunlight. And a lot of our modern windows have like UV film and things like that that will probably help too.
Keep it dark.
Right. Yeah. If you have, like my friend Chris's case here, where he has 10 different flavors of mead in 14 different cases, and he wants to display those for friends when they come over to his house, take one bottle out of each case, put them somewhere for display, and use that bottle first. And then when it gets used, replace it. That way, only one bottle is being exposed to light. That's the smart way to do it, by my way of thinking.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Yeah.
I mean, more normally I tell people I got these flavors. What do you want? And that's what I'm going to go get. I don't even display.
Right.
I mean, the only time I want display is if I'm going to go to a contest. Be honest, I want, then I'm bragging.
Well, and there are a number of people. I've seen our listeners, some of our listeners have, like, they must have gone to art school or have, like, graphic design
Oh my God,
aspirations.
Tracy. Oh, she's a graphic designer. Her labels are amazing.
Yeah, they're so the little some of those are so freaking cute. And like, I've seen so many people put so much more effort, I think, than I put into making mead, into just making the labels for their mead,
Yeah.
Like, wow.
I mean, me, if I was to make a label, you would say this flavor mead, and maybe have a line drawing behind of some variety that I yoinked off some free image thing.
Most of the time when I've made labels in the past, I took like the little stick-on address labels you get for mailing.
Well, that's what I do normally, yeah.
Right, yeah. And it'll say like, hey, semi-sweet mead with lemon blossom honey, 12% ABV, bottled on February the 6th, and maybe a 12% ABV kind of thing.
I'm even worse. I mean, I have those notes in my notes in a folder, but on the bottle itself, My chocolate banana mead says banana and a date. Maybe.
So that's if I make a label too.
Yeah, okay, fair.
There are even now cases upstairs in my office closet that I know the pink heat shrink wrap is my wife's sangria, and the green heat shrink wrap is some kind of Spanish wine that I made because the kit was getting a little old, so Jackie gave me a good deal on it back in the day, and I've still got like two or three bottles of that. And like, I didn't even bother to label them. I just know that that is that and that is that, and that's it works.
Mean,
I'm not
I'm
selling
gonna
this
put
at a
this little preface
store.
in
I don't
there.
have to.
By some means, know what you have in your bottle.
Right.
I mean, last Thursday, I drank a spicy mead and I regretted it, and it's still funny to everyone around me.
Two
And
Thursdays
that's
ago.
now that was 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
That was oh yeah, it's 2 weeks ago. Oh, the trauma is real. Anyway, 2 weeks ago, and that's because there was no label on it whatsoever. If I
No.
would have known, that would have not entered my body.
And that wasn't even one of yours. That was somebody else that was like, oh, you make meat? I make meat. Here, have a bottle.
Yeah, and I'm sitting here, sure, why not? And
Dick.
yeah, I thought we were going to be friends, but I guess not.
Now I have to kill you.
Yes. All right. So, okay. Now we also wanted to go. Okay, how do you need to be on side? Should it be upright? Is it important?
This is a
It's a wine thing.
right, and this is something that has been discussed ad nauseum for as long as we have been putting wine in bottles with corks. For a long time, the recommended storage was to store on its side, because it's natural cork. It needs a little bit of that liquid from the wine to expand, to seal that bottle properly. Modern corks, especially like I was talking about the synthetic normal corks or the agglomerated corks, those less so. It's less important because they are already fairly, like, they don't get any more like fat or thick,
They don't expand.
right? They don't expand to fit the bottle the way a natural cork does because they're already that size, that shape. I don't think it matters in those cases. Caps, obviously, same regard. There's nothing to expand, so just I would keep it upright because that's the easiest way to keep it in a box. Okay.
I mean, okay, now going to another old wine, I don't know if it's a myth, fact, whatever, turning the bottles. I mean, I just thought of this, but I remember I've talked to, sommeliers that, oh, you must turn the bottles, at X number of time. And
So,
is that even important?
yeah, there are a couple different cases where turning the bottles kind of matters. The principal reason you would turn the bottle is not to necessarily like keep the quality of the wine or keep it sealed. Essentially, it is an attractiveness and aesthetic thing because no matter how well you filtered a wine, how much your care has been put into the making of it, if you're going to keep it long term, like 10, 20, 50 years, you're going to get sediment at the bottom.
Okay.
Some of those anthocyanins will settle out even if they are in the darkest void of the abyss. They're just going to, because this is all organic stuff that things happen.
Okay.
The idea of turning it is each like quarter or eighth of an inch turn changes the plane at which that sediment settles. And if you don't do that, you can get layer after layer after layer after layer that becomes basically like a cement of sediment that
Okay,
will not move. And
but
it's
for us that we're going to be drinking within a year or two, it's not a big deal.
right. If unless you're doing long-term storage, you really don't need to worry about that. And if you're keeping it upright, all that's going to be at the bottom of the bottle anyway, so who cares? The other instance in which, those bottles are turned is a very similar reason and thought process, but if you go to the champenois method of carbonation, where they naturally carbonate champagne, they have a board that is generally like 75 to 45 degrees tilted with a bunch of holes like drilled into it so that they can stick the bottle upside down in those holes. And over the course of a few months of that final phase of fermenting, where like the last little bit of residual sugar or added sugar is turned into the carbonation in champagne, they turn those like an eighth, a quarter turn every few days to avoid the same kind of a like yeast cake
Okay.
on the side of the bottle.
Because you're actually reactivating some yeast.
Right. You need that yeast to get when you're doing the natural method of making champagne, you're getting that carbonation as a byproduct of
Yeast.
fermentation.
Okay.
Yeah. And so from what I've seen, you know, they will turn those so that it funnels into the neck of the bottle. And then towards the end of that fermentation process, they will actually take like a super saturated solution of very cold water, and they'll dip just the neck into that
Cold
solution
water.
so that this like plug of yeast at the bottom from the carbonation process freezes solid. Then they pop the temporary closure off of it. Usually it's a bottle cap, actually, from a
Okay.
lot of places I've seen. And that little chunk of yeast that's come from the carbonation just goes poof out into the middle of wherever, and they pop an actual cork on it, and then you have carbonated champagne.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's kind of
And
cool.
the first time I saw this in a video, I think it was 12-ish years ago now, I would, oh crap, that's how they do that. That makes so much sense.
Yeah,
Wow.
but that's a process. They had that was the oh, that's cool.
Yeah, no, and somebody figured this out. There were probably a couple centuries of experimentation in this because, you know, as far as I am given to understand it, the champagne style is a mistake because they bottled before you know,
The
the
yeast was gone.
primary fermentation was completed or something like that. And so when they popped it open, it was bubbly, but somebody liked the bubbles, and so they just decided to go with it.
Okay, cool. All right. Now we want to talk into a little bit of bulk aging information here.
Right.
We talked about it last time. We're going to talk about it this time now a little more in depth.
Yeah, so bulk aging is a little bit different than bottle aging. And the main difference here is that, you know, when you're aging in bulk, you're getting whatever the size of your batch is, whether it's a gallon, 3 gallons, 6, 7, 10 gallons, the same aging quality is hitting everything at once. And there are some styles of mead, especially like the Polish styles, where they are aged for a very long time. You wouldn't want to barrel, or you wouldn't, sorry, you wouldn't want to bottle age those in that, you know, long-term period, because all of them would taste a little different.
Okay, that was my next question is why?
Right. Long-term aging is to make sure that whatever you're trying to achieve by aging, whether that's getting some oak on it or just letting the flavors kind of meld together and play nice, you want to bulk age when you want that to happen to your entire batch. When you separate it into different bottles, you are separating it into different ecosystems, for lack of a better term, because
Okay.
it's cut off from everything else. And so hopefully you got a good start. You got everything pretty similar across 30 different
But
bottles.
literally, because you're in a different one to two bottles later, you could have a completely different taste,
Yeah,
or at least a subtly different taste.
you've got 30 different bottles, you've got 30 different ways things could change or be altered.
No matter how you store or anything, it's all
Right.
going to be individual.
There's, you know, you could have a little bit of a bacteria or mold strain on the inside of one cork
Fair enough.
that just changes things. And not all bacteria is bad. I think it was a cherry mead that I had made at one point that for my own oversight over the winter, you know, it gets really dry in the winter.
Oh yeah.
The airlock dried out and I got some bacteria
Ooh.
airborne in there and it settled. And so I looked at it and there was a really thin biofilm over the top. I was like, oh, I know this is infected. This is bad. And I was like, okay, well, how far gone is this? Can I hit this with my sanitizer now, or not sanitizer, my stabilizing agents now, and still save it? And so I tasted it and I was like, actually, this is nice.
So you effectively corrected a bad situation.
Well, no, it didn't require much correction on my part. It kind of accidentally came out good for being bad. There was a bacterial infection that, for whatever reason, it played nice, and the kind of vinegary-ish and acidic like end quality from that little bit of aging in a bad situation, that worked with the cherry and stuff in the mead. Obviously I stabilized it right away, got the biofilm off and bottled maybe, it was a 1 gallon batch. I bottled maybe like, I saved 8 gallon, or I'm sorry, 8 bottles worth out of that gallon. So not a, I'm sorry, 8 beer bottles out of that gallon. So,
I was going to say that sounds
right.
like
Not
small
a,
bottles.
there was some wastage in there, but what came out was still pretty nice. And my lovely wife is averse to some flavors, especially like that acidic flavor in particular. I let her try it, and she's like, "Oh, this is terrible. I hate this so much." And then I let some of our other friends taste it because, I said, "This is not bad. This is kind of okay." And it was a little bit over half that were like, "Yeah, that's actually kind of interesting and fun," and the other half were like, "That's kind of gross, and I don't like that."
Well, yeah, I use my wife has a much better sense of taste than I do. I mean, I may tease her a lot, but if it wasn't for her, I would not have as good a meat as I make because she helps me extensively. So yeah, I get that. All right, now let's see here. We've hit the bulking, so that's just to make sure you keep it consistent through several bottles.
Right. And the other, well, we've talked in our last episode, we talked about different containers. And obviously, like, if you want an inert container, the obvious choices for that for bulk aging, stainless steel or glass, right? If you want a little bit of microoxidization, or you're willing to experience a little bit of microoxidization, plastic is an option for you, and it's a perfectly good option. The thing to bear in mind, don't do like I did. Check your airlocks, make sure those are topped up, especially during the winter when it is
So dry.
drier, air wise, and evaporation happens faster than you expect it to. Kick in the pants. Another option, though, in bulk aging that is not really something that we could discuss with bottle aging, barrels.
Yeah.
Straight up barrels.
And there's actually, I've met several mead makers, master mead makers, including Tracy, who is a good friend and mentor. She made a chocolate mead, and she, I almost her, or the gentleman she was with at the moment, he aged his chocolate mead in a oak cast for like, I think it was a whiskey oak cast for like 18 months. Which brings up, how long do you age these things for bulk?
You taste and you feel. So the thing about oak, the wild thing about oak really is that you have to understand that there are a number of uses off of each barrel or cask or whatever theater thing you're using before it starts to lose some of that oak character, because this is a permeable organic thing that some of the alcohol, some of the water is seeping into the oak, some of it's seeping back out. You will lose an angel share because some of that is open to microoxidization, like airflow, things like
Explain
that.
angel share.
Sure, the angel share is in the distilling community especially, but also in winemakers. If you put something in a oak barrel or cask for a long period of time, 6 months, a year, 10 years, whatever, you're going to lose a quantity of your liquid. That's colloquially referred to, that the amount you've lost there is colloquially referred to as the angel share,
Angels get
because
that piece.
yes, that just kind of disappeared and they didn't have any other explanation for it, but it was happening all the time. So yeah, the angels must be having their share.
Fair enough. I mean, I liked the story, but I wanted that out.
Sure.
I also, when I'm bottling, if there's just a little bit left, like maybe a glass or so left, not put in the bottle,
Nope, I'm putting that in the mead baker.
that's the meat baker share there. Yeah. So, okay. Now, how long is too long? Is it all about taste?
Is all about taste. This is the kind of thing where, bare minimum, if you're doing bulk aging, long-term aging, I would taste once a month or so. Maybe every 6 weeks tops.
Okay.
If you're doing a barrel, the size of the barrel matters a lot. And
So a little barrel is.
you can get very small, like 1 or 2 gallon barrels. They actually have, for a very long time, there was a whiskey or bourbon distillery out of Texas that did 5 gallon barrels that was for whatever reason, they only, in some of their special barrel projects, they use each barrel only once. And then they would drain the barrels and sell them to a homebrew supplier.
Okay. Okay, my question, actually, let me... I understand you can get barrels from 1 to, right. You know, 500 gallon, whatever.
Well, the smaller the barrel is, the more surface area to the amount of mead there is. And so putting something in a 5 gallon barrel for a month might impart a lot of oak flavor. So putting 55 gallons of mead into a 55 gallon barrel, even if it was also just freshly drained, is not going to impart nearly as much because surface area to volume is different.
That's what I wanted to get across there, right. Because, you know, so you're going to need to check a smaller barrel, you check it more often. Mm-hmm. And was less time.
Right. Like. And also bear in mind the number of uses you've achieved on this barrel before. You're going to get a lot more, a lot faster the first use you have that barrel versus like the third or fourth or fifth for
use. 10th, whatever, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm given to understand it, around about fourth or fifth, you're not really getting a lot of the spirit character. You're getting a little oak character, and that's about it. Okay. You know, the same idea also applies to an extent with things like oak aging on the chips or the spirals or the beans or whatever you your preferred format for those is a lot of bit the surface area that all matters. And again, taste it rather frequently. The more you have going in there, the more I would taste it. The more frequently I would. You know, grab your thief and get a little sample.
Okay. So, okay, good. So, I think we need to talk about the oaking meads and such in another episode, because yes. That sounds like another subject we want to dive into there.
There are different kinds of oak. There are different loves of oak. There are different, you know...
methods of oaking.
Right. And not only that, but like, do you put it in primary? Do you leave it into secondary? Do you leave it into bulk aging kind of...
Yeah, again, this is another subject for another time.
Oh, yeah. That's an episode.
And I've done that too, but yeah, that's... yet another rabbit hole.
Yes. So...
All right. Well, I think we've covered this pretty well this time around.
I think so as well.
I want to thank you for your time, Jeff. It's always great to be here with you.
Lovely to share a glass with you, my friend. Have a good one.
And take care, everybody. We'll see you on the next Meat House.
Thank you, everybody. We'll see you soon.